The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
It was the most intense pain I've ever felt in my life.
Now, this is emotional for me. I can't imagine what it's like for you.
I gotta tell you, this is so much worse than I thought it was gonna be in terms of the solitude of it and the sense of utter isolation.
So I dropped down here and the boulder came and it smashed my left hand here and it smashed my right hand up here and then it slid down and it actually dragged my arm down and my arm was right about here. And just my instincts were just to clear my head.
Welcome, everyone. It is Thursday, December 14, 2023. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing. It's Just Right.
Color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
The horrific experience described in today's show opener from the documentary Desperate Days in Blue John Canyon, the Aaron Ralston story, was in every way a mirrored description of my own experience that occurred on the morning of Friday, October 27 at 5 a.m. From the intensity of the pain I experienced to the state of solitude and my utter isolation in which I found myself, even though I was at home in the privacy of my own bedroom. Yes, I've been offline for the past few weeks, and in more ways than one. Now that I once again find myself in front of a microphone, it's difficult to even know where to begin in acknowledging all of the people who not only made my return possible, but whose outpouring of concern and support was truly a humbling experience. I would certainly have to begin by acknowledging my daughter, Danielle, not only for seeing me through my personal crisis, but for, quite frankly, saving my very life, which was in real danger, given my state of mind and body during the first several hours following my accidental misfortune. And I must certainly thank Robert Vaughn, Paul McKeever, and Salim Mansour for having produced some excellent episodes of Just Right in my absence. And of course, there are those of you who went far beyond offering your best wishes for my speedy recovery, but who acted to help speed it along, including, among others, Conrad L., John M., Tim H., Robbie S., and others, for reasons they will clearly be aware. And then there were the great acquaintances and friends I encountered during my hospital stay, along with dozens upon dozens of staff at Victoria Hospital, whose 24/7 attention to my well-being was critical. And as strange as this may sound, beyond the tale of my own personal experience in the hospital, there were the tales of drama and crises I got to witness firsthand all around me, and finally, some philosophical epiphanies that dawned upon me in the midst of all the chaos. Our true tale of crises, drama, and resolution begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Well, it was the morning of Friday, October 27th at 5 a.m. when I found myself awakened both by the necessity of having to go to the washroom and by some noise being made outside my ground floor open bedroom apartment window. As I rose from my bed, intending to head towards the washroom, which was on my right, I instead turned to the left to attempt to first close the bedroom window to keep out the noise. And before I was even aware of what was happening, I found myself fallen on the floor of my bedroom at the foot of my bed, where my left leg struck a decorative knob on the corner of the bed, leaving me writhing in pain beyond anything I had ever experienced in my life. On a scale of 1 to 10, we're talking an easy 12. At that very moment, too, I recall very explicitly saying to myself, "All right, Metz, you're in serious trouble. This is a life-changing circumstance." And beyond the pain, my next overriding compulsion was to drink as much ice-cold water as I could get down my throat, but I couldn't get to any water. And that's when the crisis in which I found myself became very clear. Both my landline and my cell phone were in my study, and because I live on a ground floor apartment unit, I had bars and barriers on the inside of my patio door and main entrance to my apartment. I was possibly as isolated as you could get from help, given that I was in an 11-story apartment building. But even so, my unit is quite separated from the rest, given that there were several utility and building maintenance rooms isolating me from the other tenants in the building. My first goal was to get myself to a cell phone and onto my office chair, which had wheels on it, from where I could hopefully steer myself around the apartment with my good leg, and then make a phone call and remove the security bars from my doors. Centimeter by centimeter, I began crawling along the floor towards the study, with every move I made accompanied by excruciating pain and a bout of lapsed consciousness. And lo and behold, eventually I did reach my office chair, and just as I sat down on it, I heard my daughter's voice, Danielle, through the partially open study window. "Dad, are you okay?" When she heard my reply, I could sense the relief in her voice, though I wondered what it was that brought her to my place to check out the situation. "What are you doing here?" I asked, and she explained to me that my sister Kathy had called to ask her if she knew where I was, since I was expected for supper at my mother's home that evening. "What time is it?" I asked. "About 5:50, she said. It was then that I realized that I had taken around 12 to 13 hours to drag myself about 6 or 7 feet from the foot of my bed to where my office chair was. And she asked me what was wrong, and I said I think I might have broken my leg or sprained it, and attempted to convince Danielle that I had probably only bruised my leg and would follow up the next day. "Well, what's your plan?" she asked, to which I gave her some vague response about still having to go to the bathroom before being able to remove the indoor bars on my doors. With that, she left. I didn't realize she was running around looking for help, while I wheeled my office chair to the door of the bathroom, where at that point, I had to stand up to get to the toilet. Using my right leg to stand, I realized then that my left leg was simply dangling and could offer no support at all. Somehow I managed to get onto the toilet seat to finally relieve myself, and while I was sitting there, I was still so overwhelmed by thirst, I grabbed for my toothbrush glass on the counter next to me, filled it with water, and took a swig. But when I went to place the glass back on the counter, it fell to the ground, breaking the glass all over the bathroom floor, along with spilling the rest of the water that was in the glass. And were it not a tragedy, this had all the makings of a comedy skit, and that's when things got real serious. I was unable to get up to maneuver back towards my office chair, and I fell to the floor, where I spent the night semi-conscious and mostly unconscious, lying on broken glass on a wet floor. Then the next thing I remember was hearing Danielle's voice again, this time through the screen door of my patio, whose partially open glass door was still blocked by a bar on the inside. And that's when I began what proved to be another 6 or 8 hour crawl across my bathroom and living room floor, where I managed to finally remove the bar from the door just at the very moment the ambulance Danielle had called arrived at my apartment unit. Danielle handed me some cold bottled water with which I practically drowned myself, as the ambulance attendant warned me not to drink any water since I was on the way to Victoria Hospital, where the next chapter of my adventure was about to begin. I was unaware of it at the time, but I was about to find myself in the trauma unit of Victoria Hospital, situated on the 9th floor of D Block, where some of the best medical care in Canada is still available, primarily to those patients who had a condition serious enough to warrant immediate attention. And apparently I qualified, given that I had broken the femur of my left leg in two places between the knee and the hip. And fortunately, I didn't have to go through the experience of someone like Alison de Clouseau, whose own medical crisis was not resolved in Canada, as was reported on Redacted's December 5th interview with Canadian correspondent David Craden. But before listening to our excerpt from that interview, I cite the following expression of concern from longtime listener and supporter Trevor D., who, after reading about my intention to discuss my hospital experience, had this to say. Quote, "Bob, it's good to learn this news. I'm looking forward to your full return. You have been missed. Robert and Paul did an excellent job in your absence. My coworker, whom I introduced just right to, remarked to me one day something like, I wonder what Bob will have to say about our healthcare system. We were also both concerned about any COVID-19 so-called vaccination rules they may force on you in the hospital, but I said I think you have a strong enough group of family and friends around you. My coworker is very outspoken in his quote-unquote right beliefs. He is of Italian descent. I don't know if that makes any difference. But he was very impressed listening to a clip of you debating that lefty during a left, right, and center show that was featured on a Just Right broadcast. I joke that the problem with him is, ever since Benito Mussolini, some Italians like him will just not give fascism another chance. I wish you all the best in your recovery, Trevor D. Well, Trevor, I think that you may be surprised by my own observation on the points you've raised. And it is to that end that I thought we should first feature the following comments from Redacted's December 5th interview with Canadian correspondent David Craden. Because not only does this report convey a story that the world is hearing about Canada's socialized healthcare system more often with each passing day, but the circumstances necessary to access a doctor's care in Canada, in the case of Alison de Clouseau, explains a lot about how I managed to avoid waiting lists and got to receive hospital care on a timely basis. Let's listen in.
Government-assisted suicide is back at the top of the news in Canada. It's now been discovered that in Canada, part of their MAID program, the Assistance in Killing Its Citizens program, the Trudeau government apparently has been lying about the number of people who are actually killed through the MAID program. They lead the world, by the way, in euthanasia. We also have another angle to this story, a woman who was basically assigned as part of the MAID program to be killed in Canada, managed to get life-saving surgery by crossing the border into the United States. And now she's okay. So she would have been killed in Canada, went to the United States and was saved with life-saving surgery. So what is going on with these numbers? What is Canada trying to hide? David Craden, who writes at the Post-Millennial, has been covering this story extensively, done a great job, and joins us now.
Stats Canada, which is Statistics Canada, and I'll tell you a bit more about them in a minute. But they have revealed on their own website, this is the beauty of this, if you will. They're so proud of their deception that they put it on their website. And Stats Canada revealed, and I'll read it exactly, what they have done in terms of reporting the data for the Medical Assistance in Suicide. That's Canada's euthanasia program. No bones about it. It's a euthanasia program. And it says, quote, in the database, the underlying cause of death is defined as the disease or injury that initiated the train of morbid events leading directly to death. As such, MAID deaths are coded to the underlying condition for which MAID was requested. So to break that down into common English, it's saying they're going to report MAID deaths based on the reason, the medical reason, if there is one, that somebody decided they wanted medically assisted suicide. For the last year that we have numbers for, which is 2022, 13,200 people committed suicide through the MAID program. The year before, over 10,000. What are the numbers for this year? certainly more than 13,000. They're escalating. So we're looking about at least 35,000 people who have sought suicide through Canada's euthanasia program. There's been documentaries reporting that Canada is the suicide capital of the world. It's the assisted suicide capital of the world. People are literally coming to Canada to die.
So tell us about Allison in Canada. This is an amazing story, and it's part of this medical assistance in death, the MAID program story. She had cancer, abdominal cancer, in British Columbia. And, well, you walk us through what happened to Allison.
It's a fascinating story, and I'm happy to say that there is a happy ending to the story. Not thanks to Canada, though, but it's Allison Ducluso from Victoria, B.C., and that's on the far west coast of Canada. And she was diagnosed with abdominal cancer only because she wound up in emergency one night. Because as far as the doctors were concerned, she really couldn't see a doctor. So she ended up in emergency because she collapsed. Then they said, well, you know, the reason you collapsed is you have fairly well advanced abdominal cancer. Subsequent examinations revealed it was stage 4 cancer. She had from 2 months to 2 years, probably a lot less than that, to live. So while she was desperately trying to get treatment in Canada, to get an operation, because she needed help immediately, what did they offer her? Not assistance through the British Columbia Cancer Agency. They said, well, you know what's available, Allison? The Medical Assistance in Dying program. If it's just too much for you, we'll offer you suicide. And she mentions this in an aside, like, I went to get help and they offered me MAID instead. And it's just, she's aware of the irony. She's aware of how horrible this is. How can they do that? And yet, the publicly funded healthcare system in Canada, Medicare, the socialized medicine program that Justin Trudeau is always bragging about, that a lot of American politicians are bragging about. Bernie Sanders loves to brag about socialized medicine in Canada. It completely failed her because it could not save her life. She would have been on a waiting list probably for years. She had to go to the United States to get the cancer removed, to have the life-saving operation, because Medicare failed her. All they could offer her was suicide, not life. Thank God she's well today, but my God, she's a critic of Canadian Medicare because she's saying there's something horrible about this system. 65,000 Canadians every year leave Canada for the United States to get healthcare, to get life-saving operations. Allison's not alone. 65,000 and 12, and Canadians pay $12,000 a year minimum in their taxes to pay for their so-called free Medicare in Canada. There's nothing free about it. It's cheaper to get private insurance. So it's not free and it doesn't work.
Consider that Allison Ducluso was diagnosed only because she ended up in emergency. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been able to access a doctor in Canada. And therein lies the key to getting something approaching true medical care within the Canadian socialized healthcare system. It has long been a fundamental principle of Canada's socialized Medicare monopoly that the road to quick medical care is to be found in crisis or in being near death. And that is why, in my case, I managed to pierce the veil of waiting lists and was able to be admitted into the trauma unit of Victoria Hospital. And the bizarre paradox of the Canadian government now pushing euthanasia under the guise of an acronym called MAID, Medical Assistance in Dying, when contrasted against the positive efforts of parts of the medical establishment to save lives and to restore health, is a bitter reality to accept. But all socialized medicine and healthcare is rationed healthcare, and the false belief that only through state-financed and monopolized health care is such care available is a myth that has cost millions of lives. The idea that universal health care is perfectly achievable without the coercive force of governments is lost on most people, thanks to persistent state propaganda campaigns asserting the opposite. But that's an argument to be made for another day, and has been made many times in the past on this show. But to quickly respond to Trevor's concerns about mandated COVID rules and vaccination requirements, I am pleased to report that these concerns were nowhere to be found during my entire stay in hospital. I personally witnessed one staff member refuse to get any kind of vaccine after being asked, including the annual flu vaccine, and this was perfectly acceptable to the hospital management. No patients wore masks, although most nurses, doctors, and personal assistants did so, but even there were some exceptions. So when the ambulance delivered me to the emergency room at London, Ontario's Victoria Hospital, all I recall was the incredible activity and noise and bright lights all around me. Instruments beeping, doctors talking to each other. It was like almost like you were at a bazaar of some sort. With my leg still broken and unattended to at this point, I was obviously kept on a number of painkillers and other drugs whose effect I have still to assess. I was kept in the emergency department over the weekend of October 28 and 29th until I was finally checked into a semi-private room on Monday the 30th of October, and this was on the 9th floor of the hospital, otherwise known as the trauma unit. Little did I know that I would still be in that room until November 21st, followed by another 4 days in the discharge section of the hospital. Ironically, I entered the hospital on October 28th and was discharged on November 28th, one solid month of being immersed in a completely alien environment, but with a front row seat to watching how the inside operations of Canada's working hospital system functions. Now, I was originally scheduled for surgery on my leg for November 1st, and following a nerve block on my leg, they took me down to the operating theater where I was only to be returned to my room due to a scheduling error. You know, I knew there was something seriously amiss when the doctor in surgery asked me, when did I have my toe amputated? Which was not the case. And following that mix-up, I finally got my surgery on November 2nd, following a second nerve block on my leg, which basically leaves the leg feeling entirely numb. And part of my leg still feels a bit that way to this day. So, you can well imagine my shock when on the first day following surgery, November 3rd, a team of physiotherapists already had me standing up on my leg and then had me sit in a chair for some 90 minutes or so. But my problems multiplied when doctors became concerned with my low hemoglobin levels and began performing a series of tests to determine the cause, something that has not quite been determined to this day. I'm still having blood tests taken as an outpatient, and during my hospital stay, I underwent 2 scopes, which include putting a camera down your throat and into your stomach in search of possible ulcers, plus 2 CT scans that pretty much check out a whole host of physical conditions. I also received several blood transfusions, which rather concerned me, particularly since I had some negative reactions to them. Now bear in mind that I hadn't been to a doctor for a checkup since my early 20s, and I can say that I've been very fortunate enough to make it into my 70s without any medical interventions required. So now apparently I'm playing catch-up. They now have me on a regimen of regularly taking everything from B12 to vitamin D4 to calcium to having me read literature on osteoporosis. It's kind of like having a late midlife crisis, if you know what I mean. So, in essence, my stay in hospital was longer than that required for a simple bone repair, and it was almost as if I was being treated for 2 differing issues, which brought to mind an observation made by John Manley, author of Much Ado About Corona, and who was a guest on an earlier episode of Just Right. John has had extensive experience with the Canadian and Ontario healthcare system, and actually both praised and condemned it. In his opinion, the Canadian healthcare system excels in the field of trauma care and fails utterly in the area of chronic care. and it is certainly a conversation worth pursuing at some point in the future. But as to the trauma care I received, my broken leg does not have a cast. My femur was repaired by inserting metal rods inside the bone, and the visible effects of this surgery are quite minimal. But I've still got a long way to go before I can consider my leg to be back to quote-unquote normal. So now you pretty well know how I got myself into this predicament where I was pretty much held hostage in a bed for a full month. But what I saw and experienced from the vantage point of that bed, being situated in a semi-private room in which I usually had another patient in the room to talk to, was both a learning experience and, from time to time, an entertaining experience as well. To begin with, and I have to say this, the nurses and personal assistants in attendance were absolutely phenomenal. They did everything they possibly could to assist the patients and to see to their well-being. And many of them were students being openly trained by their nurses and mentors. I got to sit in, or I guess you could say lie in, on many a medical lecture and learning experience. And most of it kind of flew over my head because it was pretty complex stuff. But the most remarkable thing about the trauma unit was that it was a very functional, collectivized form of healthcare, with a different nurse, a different personnel assistant or physiotherapist circulated every 12 hours at the 7 o'clock shift change. Every morning and evening at 7 o'clock, I could hear the staff update each other on the progress made or not made by the various patients. And it was rare that I would encounter the same nurse or assistant on a subsequent day, though it did happen, particularly with the physiotherapist. In order to maintain a continuity of care with each patient, all of the hospital staff were equipped with computers and screens indicating each patient's status, including everything from when a bowel movement was taken to when the last drugs and painkillers were administered. And by the way, contrary to popular opinion, the food served at Victoria Hospital Trauma Unit was excellent. Every day, 8 a.m., 12 noon, 5 p.m., each patient would receive a full course meal of his or her own choosing as determined on a filled-out menu presented to the staff the day earlier. And I gotta tell you, I never ate so much in my life. So that was certainly a pleasant surprise and a relief on my part. But in many respects, the hospital was also a school, a training ground for future doctors, nurses, and other healthcare practitioners. And in this practice, various teams were formed so as to accommodate differing students and trainers. I got to see it all firsthand. And the action never stopped, even in the middle of the night, when the patients would always be awakened in order to take their vitals, administer medicines, and do blood work. It was kind of exasperating after a while. And that, I suppose, sets the stage for the rest of my hospital narrative, which continues when we return.
Dr. Resnick was orphaned once Dr. Coyle was transferred, so she'll be joining our team.
Hi, I'm Claire. Nice to meet you. Are you the autistic one?
No.
That's me, Dr. Sean Murphy.
Okay. We've got two pretty straightforward cases. Nice level playing field for an eager group.
Not interested.
Competition can foster teamwork, which can lead to a greater understanding and appreciation of residents' strengths and weaknesses and improve patient care.
You're playing the same game Glassman had us do when we were interns. Not interested.
Winning team gets first dibs on assisting on all surgeries next week.
In.
I pick the boy genius.
That's you.
Dr. Brown.
Kalu.
Dr. Resnick.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Same stakes as last time?
Absolutely.
What do you want?
I would like to see our patients, please.
Oh, you're the new lot, are you?
That's us, sister.
Well, perhaps we'd better get started.
Yeah.
Morning, sir.
Morning.
I'm a medical student, and I wonder if you'd mind if we had a little chat.
Not at all. I'm suffering from thyrotoxicosis, which first presented itself 18 months ago with tremor, palpitations, sweating, and loss of weight.
I see. Could I have your name, please?
Yeah, Williams. Dr. Peter Williams.
Oh, good.
Yeah. As I was saying, if you examine me now, you'd find a slight tachycardia, say 98 beats per minute, the classical signs of lid lag, tremor, and a small nodular swelling in the thyroid gland. I'm not going too fast for you, am I?
Oh, no. Do carry on.
So the diagnosis was obviously thyrotoxicosis.
Oh, obviously. Right then, Mr. Whale, what seems to be the trouble?
I'm worried about my sex life, Doctor.
Oh?
It's dropping off.
Good God.
I'm not the man I was, Doctor. Tell you the truth, I don't feel the urge no more.
Really?
Anyway, up till then, I was doing fine.
You certainly were.
Then I started sort of slowing up. It was Vera that first noticed it. No, hang on, wait a minute, was it Marge? No, I tell a lie. No, it was that girl I was seeing down in Wapping. What was her name?
Mavis.
No, that's me wife, Mavis.
Now then, sir, what seems to be the trouble?
I've lost me hat.
What I mean is, what's wrong with you?
I don't know where it can be. I've lost me hat, you see. I think somebody's pinched it.
Let me put it another way. Why are you in hospital?
Where's my hat?
I told you, I don't know. Now, please just tell me
somebody's
what's wrong with
you. Somebody's got my hat. Who's got my hat, Doctor? Have you got it?
Oh, of course not.
You've got it, haven't you?
No!
You've got my hat! You've stolen my hat! Nurse! Give me back my hat! I want my hat! Help! Thief! Help!
What?
Hey, he's got my hat! He's got my hat! He's got my hat!
What's going on in here? Leave him alone! Get out!
I didn't do anything!
He's taken my hat!
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. As a patient sharing a semi-private room, I got to share my room with no fewer than 9 other patients over the month I was there, about whom I'll have some brief comments to make while protecting their anonymity. Meanwhile, my daughter Danielle brought in a power bar to plug in beside my bed, which accommodated my electric shaver, charged my cell phone, and the laptop that was lent to me by Tim H., and which rescued me from hours of otherwise abject boredom, and that was a big issue to have to deal with. The hospital rooms no longer have audiovisual equipment. In fact, the last remnants of such were removed from my room while I was there. But the hospital does provide free Wi-Fi, enabling everyone's devices to connect to the internet. Now, my first roommate when I arrived in our semi-private room was a fellow named Doug O, who happened to be a blog fan, and with whom I have kept in touch since he was discharged. In fact, he's already forwarded a YouTube link to my attention featuring Tom Hartman in a presentation entitled How America Got All Effed Up and Resurrecting Democracy in America, from which I've already archived the audio track for possible use in a future broadcast. Some very interesting history there. The second patient to share my room was a woman from Iraq in her 90s who was accompanied by a family member named Sam, and with whom I got into a very lively discussion about Iraq and the Mideast situation. Even more coincidentally, Sam turned out to be an avid shortwave radio fan, and I had hoped to have some more conversations with him about that, but his mother was almost immediately moved to Parkwood Hospital, which specializes in physiotherapy, so I never got the chance to continue those particular conversations. The next patient joining me in the room was a young kid from Owen Sound, where apparently he was involved in a car crash resulting from a police chase. He was not the driver, but apparently the car in which he and a few of his friends were riding was neither licensed nor insured. And I never really got a chance to talk to him much personally, but his family members were generally in the room with him for much of the short time that he spent there until his discharge. And just before his discharge, there was an interesting event that occurred. That was when two plainclothes police officers who I swear could have been lifted from the characters in the TV show Dragnet. They entered the room as agents of the Special Investigations Unit, the SIU, to question him about the car accident. And I couldn't believe my ears that when they entered the room, the kid's mother says something unbelievable. Quote, "Don't believe a word he says, officer, because he's a compulsive liar," end quote. And suddenly the phrase, "a mother's love," took on a new meaning for me. The next roommate I was teamed up with happened to be another fellow from the Owen Sound area named John F., and from whom we may be hearing more in the future. He has a story that he would like to share regarding his experience with the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario, and it sounded like it might be an interesting one. John was somewhat unceremoniously discharged from the room right in the middle of a supper hour one day, when suddenly my room was inundated with people from the cleaning staff and support staff who had to clear the space left by John for a subsequent patient. And apparently, the big issue of the day was that they're reintroducing hallway medicine. Sure enough, suddenly my room was full of hospital employees, all in shock about how, quote-unquote, hallway medicine was making some kind of comeback. "Can you believe what they're doing?" was the general tone of their conversation. My next roommate was a fellow named T.G., who, now in his mid-70s, seemed somewhat obsessed over a failed marriage that ended decades ago. And T.G. didn't seem to be quite connected to reality, and almost every time he was asked by the nursing staff if he knew where he was, he didn't. On one occasion, after Danielle paid me a visit and we talked about the grandkids and how much fun they had on Halloween, T.G. thanked me for allowing him to sit in my living room and listen in on the conversation. I just accepted his thanks and didn't say much else about it. But when the staff later directed T.G. to the bathroom to get him to have a bowel movement, and I'll tell you, that's one of the major events going on in the hospital. It's all about going to the bathroom and eating and issues like that. But he refused to cooperate, arguing that the bathroom was my private property and he couldn't allow himself to use it. Bizarre thinking. And I later asked the nurse if there were many patients who seemed to never know where they were or why they were there. And she leans over to me and looks me right in the eye and she says, "Robert, right now, you are my only patient who knows where he is." Yikes. And that told a story. Needless to say, I was never really able to get to know T.G., unlike my next roommate named Chris S., with whom I had a lot in common, and we both happened to live in the London area. We seemed to enjoy a lot of the same classic TV shows, in particular Star Trek, and each of us recommended favorite shows and movies to each other. I introduced Chris to the classic Honey West TV series, which aired when I was a kid, and sure enough, he found the series on YouTube, including an unaired pilot that I was unaware of and which now I have added to my collection. And during Chris's stay in hospital, he celebrated his mother's birthday, who was in her 90s. He did this via a cell phone while other members of the family were joining him in the hospital. And his wife Pauline brought me my own piece of birthday cake along with a special napkin, which I have now kept as a souvenir of that event. But after Chris was discharged, my last co-occupant of our semi-private room on the 9th floor was a patient named Darlene, who was moved to this room, interestingly enough, temporarily, because she was previously on another floor with only one other patient on that entire floor, which made it difficult for nurses and personal assistants to respond to their calls in a timely fashion. So they moved them up into the floor that had more people on it. So as crowded and as busy as things seemed to be on the 9th floor, there were still clearly large sections of the hospital unoccupied. And it was at this point that I myself was now moved from the trauma unit to another wing and floor in the hospital where patients were waiting to be discharged. And over the 4 days or so that I spent in that semi-private room, I pretty much had the room to myself for most of the time, though I did have two other people briefly occupy the room along with me. And when I was finally discharged and arrived at home, I discovered a new set of problems awaiting me. Upon returning home, it was clear there was a brief power outage, given that all of my 4 still operating desktop computers had rebooted, save for one. My main computer, which runs on an XP platform, on which I perform most of the project works and show episodes producing this show, including mailing lists and mailers and all that kind of thing. So, in producing this week's show, I now find myself having not only to relearn how to walk, but how to produce each episode of Just Right strictly on my Windows 10 platform machine, which is still quite new and unfamiliar to me. Some things I like about it, some things are definitely a disadvantage. So if this broadcast sounds a bit different in quality or texture from what you've been used to, perhaps that's the reason. I'm also recording it in a different room than I normally do. But this is not where my hospital story ends. So far I've shared the basic, I guess, superficial facts and general observations I had. But the personal experience of both myself and many of the other people I encountered is yet another dimension to this whole hospital encounter.
Okay, deep tenderness at McBurney's point. Could be acute appendicitis.
Murphy, get imaging to confirm.
Mr. Shaw, your chart says that you passed out in class. What do you teach?
History. I got a little dizzy because I skipped breakfast. It's nothing. The school insisted on calling an ambulance.
Taken any medications in the last few months?
I took some Vicodin after I threw out my back 6 weeks ago. And then I had a stomach flu, so I took ofloxacin, but the flu part didn't totally go away, so I took azithromycin and prednisone because my glands were swollen, but I still had a sore throat, so I took some Cipro.
What doctor prescribed you all that?
They were leftovers I had in my medicine cabinet.
All right, leave it for me.
Look, I'm a single dad with twins who bring home every disgusting germ they touch. Preschool. I can't afford to miss work.
You've got a fever, and you've gone through two IVs, which tells me that you're severely dehydrated. You can't stand me touching your stomach without wincing in pain. Dr. Resnick, let's get Mr. Shaw here an ultrasound.
I'm afraid, Howard, your appendix has already ruptured.
We're going to our stat and Paige Melendez.
Wait, I need to figure out who's going to take care of my kids, call the school so they can get subs for my classes.
Mr. Shaw, if we don't get you into surgery now, your infection could spread and you could become septic. Dr. Brown will make all the necessary phone calls while I prep you for surgery. Isn't that so, Dr. Brown?
You're in good hands, Mr. Shaw. We've got you covered.
Let's go. It's Howard.
Spike to fever, temps 105. BP's tanking 80 over 40.
You sold his sheets?
Site's clean. Infection should be clearing by now. What's going on?
I don't know. Paige Melendez. Give me 500 milligrams of acetaminophen, 2 grams of meropenem, IV infusion empirically.
Run a full chem panel, CBC, and get cultures ASAP.
Hang in there, Howard. We're gonna figure this out.
Get on.
I didn't. I haven't even seen my patient yet. I've been down in physiotherapy for the last hour. Should be back soon.
Well, you better get back quick before they stick him on a bedpan.
I had the most marvelous chap. He's a doctor, so he knows all about his condition. Practically wrote my notes for me. He's suffering from thyrotoxicosis.
Is he?
My God.
Hello, Duncan. What's your chap got?
Long fingernails.
What have you got there?
Oh, I pinched the doctor's notes out the file. I couldn't get any sense out of that old basket. So I thought I'd just copy out the houseman's notes.
Isn't that cheating? You can't do that.
It is cheating, and I can do that.
London's Victoria Hospital is in effect a city within a city. Helicopters fly in regularly, bringing patients from various parts of the province, and arriving ambulances could be heard on a regular basis. And the significance of these arrivals impacted me in a different way when I allowed myself to consider the nature of the injuries and trauma that those being transported to the hospital were likely experiencing. But given many of the news items and stories about Canada's healthcare crisis, all of this activity seemed incongruous with the report. And throughout the whole process, let me say that I heard some screams of pain from patients that you just can't unhear, if you know what I mean. Sometimes, when someone's surgery was being postponed, We would later learn that there were injured people arriving with bones protruding from their bodies, to say nothing about what the condition of their other bodily organs might have been. And all of this activity continues nonstop, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Now, one of the major points that I haven't really mentioned yet is that one thing most of the patients in the trauma unit shared in common was the pain factor. How each individual reacts to pain, whether their own or the pain of others, can be as different as night and day. For me, given the nature of my own injury, I found myself in the position of a person who's been paralyzed from the waist down, and so became utterly dependent upon other people to see to my every physical need, from providing me with food to dealing with the waste produced by my body. And let me say from the outset that should you find yourself in a similar situation someday, be sure to set any notions of your personal physical dignity aside, because there's just no such thing in this environment. One of the first things doctors had to do upon my arrival at the hospital, as is the case with most patients, was to insert a catheter through the penis into the bladder, a procedure which, to my utter surprise, did not cause me any discomfort at all, both when inserted and when removed. In fact, I missed the convenience of the catheter when it was removed, because from that point onward, I had to learn how to urinate into a plastic urinal container with a handle on it that would be hung on the side of the bed each time it was used. Then I would have to push a button on my bed, which called for a personal assistant to come and empty the urinal into a toilet, and then hang the empty on the side of my bed for its subsequent use. And as far as bowel movements were concerned, a good old-fashioned diaper had to suffice, with nursing attendants and personal assistants having to take care of cleanup operations no different than what would be done with a baby's diaper. And this was basically the procedure until I was well enough to use a walker to get to the bathroom on my own, where commodes were provided to make that experience easier to negotiate. I bring this to your attention because this was pretty much the condition under which almost all of the patients in the trauma unit were operating. And when also suffering with the injury of broken bones, etc., every time they had to be moved, for anything from having to visit a washroom to being put on a gurney for transport to another part of the hospital, the pain encountered by the motion could be excruciating, and the patients would make it clear that this was so. Now, beyond the physical trauma and challenges of being in the hospital, there was also the psychological experience to deal with. Above all, the boredom factor faced when you can't move beyond the confines of the bed that you're lying in. One of my first escapes from this boredom was to reread John C.A. Manley's Much Ado About Corona, which I had last read when interviewing the author for a broadcast of Just Right back on February 23rd of this year, show 799 entitled Brave New Normal. But this time, the experience of reading that book took on a whole new dimension, because it became a chilling reminder of just how insane things in Ontario had become back in 2020 during the height of the COVIDian crisis. Although the story itself was fiction, the environment in which it took place was not. And in contrast to what was going on in this Ontario hospital in 2023, it was almost difficult to believe just how dystopian things were only a few short years ago. I counted my blessings that I didn't find myself in hospital during that godforsaken period in time, and still find myself somewhat angry that the hospitals have not hired back all of the doctors and nurses who refused to take the experimental injections. Nevertheless, rereading the book was still a welcome relief from the boredom of laying in a hospital bed all day. Another boredom reliever turned out to be the laptop, lent to me by a friend, but not in the way I expected. In fact, I found myself faced with an unexpected dilemma when I first got the laptop going and began to see what was new online and in the social media. To my utter amazement and surprise, I found all of the usual bloggers, commentators, and websites that I frequented with regularity in the normal course of a week to be utterly uninteresting to me. And my own disinterest on this count utterly shocked me, and I began to worry that this might become a permanent condition. How am I going to do the show when I get back? And strangely enough, this became a mission, a riddle for me to solve to understand what had caused this bizarre turnabout of disinterest. And sure enough, I eventually came up with a theory that led me to an epiphany I have since found deeply resonates with many of the people I presented it to. And not only that, but my theory led to a psychological domino effect that broadly impacts everything from metaphysics to aesthetics, and which can be applied to almost every topic we generally discuss on Just Right. So, here's my working theory as to the sudden cause of my disinterest in things I would normally be interested in. And most simply put, it goes something like this, and I'll put it in quotes. Quote, without one's ability to take action, interest in all things is essentially lost. End quote. Let me say that again. Without one's ability to take action, interest in all things is essentially lost. There I was, reduced to a state of inaction while confined in my hospital bed, and by action, I'm not just referring to the ability to walk, but even to meaningfully react to or share my interest with others. And I've noticed the same phenomena in other people, particularly people who have to deal with pain constantly and are therefore distracted from other concerns and interests outside their daily lives and the pain they have to deal with. Fortunately, once I became a little bit more mobile, and could see being more so in the future, my interests slowly returned back to normal, and among the first things I listened to were the episodes of Just Right produced in my absence. Robert Vaughn did a superb job in producing those shows, something I know he finds most frustrating, given how much time and effort have to go into the show's production, even after the narratives and interviews have been recorded. So those episodes were certainly a treat for me, especially given my lack of participation in their creation. And the other unexpected treat I listened to from Just Right's website were a number of left, right, and center episodes in which I appeared as a panelist back in the days before Just Right came into being. I took notes while listening to them, and it was shocking to me that so many of the topics we discussed those many decades ago echoed the very ones we continue to discuss today. The nature of representative government, evil versus good, democracy versus majority rule, Vladimir Putin, the military-industrial complex, the China question, fascism versus capitalism, population controls, the mass psychology of fascism, the fundamental issue of sovereignty and the nature of citizenship, and of course the Mideast tragedy and the Palestinians. We were talking about all of that decades ago. And you can bet that you'll soon be hearing some of these discussions surfacing again on future broadcasts of Just Right. But I digress. In entertaining my theory that without one's ability to take action, interest in all things is essentially lost, that philosophical domino effect that broadly impacts everything from metaphysics to aesthetics that I mentioned earlier began to come into focus in a way I have rarely viewed it, though I know we've discussed the individual elements of this many times in the past. And believe it or not, I'm referring to the very nature of existence and humanity's role within that existence. I haven't put it all together as yet with a definitive statement of any sort, but here are the moving parts of the existence equation, if you'll pardon the pun, because motion is what it's really all about. And motion generally refers to the workings of the universe, while action, a specific form of motion, refers to the workings of humanity. Are you beginning to see where I'm going with this? When we speak of the eternal nature of existence, we are speaking of all that exists, whether within our field of knowledge or outside it. Existence exists, and to try to argue otherwise is to argue a contradiction, one that I've often expressed in the saying, there ain't no such thing as nothing, honey, 'cause if there were, wouldn't that be something? In the most visible metaphysical terms discernible to human beings, existence would be experienced and viewed as the universe itself, while in aesthetic or religious terms, existence would be referred to as the supreme being, the being of all, as opposed to the non-being of anything. And of course, humanity has given the supreme being the name of God. Perhaps the most fundamental characteristic of the universe is that everything in the universe is in constant motion. And I would say that in this context, this principle holds true even with regard to the phenomenon of entropy, but that's another discussion entirely. Within the motions of the universe, we find ourselves contending with the phenomenon of time, energy, matter, heat, cold, light and dark, gravity, and the basic elements and principles of existence, such as the law of non-contradiction. It's interesting to note that when it comes to energy and matter, heat is associated with rapid motion, while cold is associated with a very minimal motion. And also interesting is the fact that light is not heat, nor can it be seen. When it comes to light, what human beings can perceive is only the source of the light and the reflection of the light. Now, when we turn our focus to human beings and human behavior, we are no longer dealing just with motion, but with a specific form of motion, which I shall refer to as action. Action is motion with a purpose behind it. Action is a form of motion initiated by a human will, which in turn is often motivated by yet another form of motion we interestingly call emotion. Now, I checked out my Funk and Wagnalls dictionary, and it described emotion thusly, quote, a strong surge of feeling marked by an impulse to outward expression and often accompanied by complex bodily reactions, end quote. And it is to that impulse, to outward expression, that the motion and emotion addresses. And that sure sounded a lot like the impulse that was repressed in my own state of mind when I found myself unable to exercise that impulse to outward expression. I ceased to have any emotional connection to the things I normally would have had. And then I checked the etymology of the word emotion, and it reads as follows. Middle French, from émouvoir, to stir up, from Old French, esmouvoir, from Latin, émouvoir, to remove, displace, from e plus mouvoir, to move. So the very term emotion certainly has everything to do with motion itself. And this leads us to the next stage in this journey, two specific things that in all living creatures affect their emotions, pain and pleasure. The former being what most people who find themselves in the hospital want to relieve. Pain and pleasure can also be expressed in their more subtle forms as discomfort or comfort. But when it comes to being a motivator, something that causes or prevents action, our human behavior becomes much easier to understand. Pain either forces action or it ends it, depending upon how severe the pain is. Pleasure, on the other hand, encourages action by reward. Discomfort and comfort, subsets of pain and pleasure, are more of a test of one's tolerance. So those are my painful admissions and discoveries for this week's show. And whether your motivator is pain or pleasure, we hope that you'll be motivated to join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Now, Upton, this young lady has a little lump in the left breast. It's nothing serious, but she was quite right to see her doctor about it. And I want you to tell me what it is.
I don't know, sir.
Well, of course you don't. Of course you don't know. Find out.
Yes, sir.
Stop. Upton, am I right in thinking this is the first time you've met this young lady?
Yes, sir.
So you do not march up to her, make her grab at her bosom. No, sir. Remember your manners, boy. Now shake her by the hand and introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Michael.
Oh, for God's sake. Miss Walker, this is Dr. Upton, who wishes to examine you if you've no objections.
No, carry on.
Thank you. There you are, Upton. Get on with it. Stop! Control yourself, Upton. I've spent the last hour teaching you how to examine a patient. It obviously hasn't percolated through to that atrophied conglomerate of malformed neurons you use for a brain that you ask questions first.
Sorry, sir.
Well, get on.
Yes, sir.
Now, see if you can at least manage to find out the patient's name.
Yes, sir. What is your name?
Marlene Walker.
She's Marlene Walker, sir.